This talk this evening, I would characterize it as sort of skipping stones across the pond. Okay, we're going to be slowly just pointing out little fun little things, theological truths and thoughts from the Thomistic tradition, from Catholic doctrine and Catholic belief, about that question, about God, human nature, body, flesh, and Catholic belief. To begin, let me just remind you of a passage from the scripture that we're all, with which we are all very familiar. It's from the opening verses of the Gospel of John. You know it. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Now, after those wonderful verses, of which all of us have heard numerous times, several verses later, John the Evangelist writes the great truth at the heart of Christianity. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, the glory as of the only Son from the Father. What I hope to show this evening in our time together is that this truth about Jesus Christ, that he took flesh in the incarnation, is not simply an afterthought or a sort of plot point, if you will, in God's story of salvation. It's intrinsic. It is the reason for our salvation. It's the reason, it's intrinsic to the salvation that Jesus Christ achieves for you and I. And it's because the Word, God himself, took flesh that Christians have been meditating and thinking about very concrete and tangible realities for 2,000 years. Like the importance and meaning of the body, importance and dignity of human nature, because now God has assumed a human nature. So tonight, I'm going to share with you some of the fruits, as I say, skipping stones, of the conclusions of this theological tradition, a particular stream of the tradition, the Thomistic stream, of this notion of Catholicism as a bodily religion, tangible religion. Now, to do that, I'm going to highlight three tendencies about the Catholic belief in incarnation and the body. And then I will conclude with just three very quick avenues, if you will, that I hope you might remember or think about for further reflection on what this means for our lived faith as Catholics. Now, truth be told, at our faculty at the Dominican House of Studies, any one of these three things, any one of the three points I'm going to present, or any one of the three avenues, each of these could be an elective for an entire semester. Right? So that's why we're just skipping stones here. Here are the three tendencies I want to share tonight. First, the fact that Christ took human flesh has catalyzed the Christian reading of the Old Testament, and very specifically, the narratives plural, of creation that we find in the first few chapters of the book of Genesis. So what it means to be a human person. Secondly, that Christianity has a definite understanding of the nature of sin in relation to the body and human nature. And this is manifest in all sorts of ways historically. We might touch a little bit on that. And sometimes not, hasn't always been manifest in the healthiest of ways. And then finally, we'll speak of Jesus Christ, his flesh, his human nature, and its role in our salvation. So to begin, the first two chapters of the book of Genesis are the natural starting point for a consideration of the body or the flesh and the nature of the human person. If you're familiar with St. John Paul II's theology of the body, catechesis, you know that's where he begins. He calls those, this is going to be a paraphrase, I don't remember his exact words, but he calls certainly the second chapter of Genesis, that creation narrative in which we find man in the garden. He calls that a sort of inspired, primal memory of man's existential condition in the world. A couple of things to note about the creation narrative of Genesis. You know, the first chapter of Genesis is the narrative of creation, the creation of the earth and the heavens in 7 days. There's all sorts of fascinating and wonderful things about the structure of that. The first 3 days sort of are the places. The second 3 days fill up those places. So, you know, you have the heavens, and then in the fourth day, we have the sun and the moon. So there's all sorts of fascinating things about that that we can't occupy ourselves with this evening. And then, of course, the second chapter, as I said, specifically mentions the creation of the garden, the placement of Adam in the middle of it, and eventually the creation of Eve. So one thing to note about about creation in Genesis is that, unlike many of the other myths of ancient religions about the creation of the world, in which we often see creation, and certainly the creation of the earth, and sometimes even of humanity, as a result of some primal war, or some primal battle, or some primal act of violence between ancient deities, so that creation in such a myth, in such a religion, becomes marked, in fact, by a trend of violence. It's sort of written, hardwired in to the creation itself. In Genesis, creation comes about simply through the will of God and the power of speech. He speaks and things happen. Right? For the ancient Israelites, for the Hebrews, speech, for this reason, is very powerful. Right? So you see this throughout the Old Testament. When somebody speaks, sort of for instance, giving a blessing, the blessing goes forth and it's effective. Right? So Jacob gets the blessing. It can't be brought back and given to his brother who should have gotten it. Speech is powerful. This is also what's behind the prohibition of speaking the name of God. We don't speak the name of God in the Old Testament because speech is effective, it's powerful. In Genesis, creation comes about through God speaking, and it is declared good. Step by step, it is declared good. So this is a fundamental locus of revelation. This is a fundamental datum, if you will, of God's revelation. That the world is created good. Man is created good. The body is created good. The flesh is good in and of itself. Now, moreover, in the second chapter of Genesis, we see man placed in a garden, and the Lord giving him everything in that garden, except, of course, a fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, giving him everything in that garden to eat. So we see a certain harmony between humanity and creation. We see also in Genesis chapter 2 a sort of co-working with God. Man is to till the garden. He is to be a steward with, what? Opposable thumbs, a body. And he can work the land. He is to cultivate. He is to be fruitful. He works with God, once again, with speech. Power of speech, to name the animals. He names them, and that's what they're called, through the body, power of the voice. Now, for our purposes, the key verse of the second chapter of Genesis is verse 7. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. The breath, in Hebrew, the neshama, is the spirit of God. Elsewhere in the Old Testament, the same word appears that speaks of the spirit of man. It is spirit. The breath of life is spirit. So, already in Genesis, and you can see how much later in the Christian tradition, we see the further reflection happening of these two principles, the dust, the stuff, the matter, and the spirit. Matter and form, to use philosophical terms borrowed from Plato and Aristotle, how some church fathers even came to articulate it, and, if I might say so with some prejudice, came to full and perfect articulation in the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. The human person is a composite, St. Thomas argues, of matter and form, the body, the stuff, the form, the spirit, the soul. This we would refer to as a very strict, and the word here is hylomorphism, is the theory that the body and soul are so united, so intertwined, even though that still is, that those words still don't do it justice, that they are, in a sense, codependent on each other. Even that implies a certain separation that is lacking, that is not in Sir St. Thomas's thought. St. Thomas had realized that these two components, the body and soul, are inextricably linked in every activity we engage in this world. Every activity. The body is the material, the rational soul is what gives that material the form. Right? This is a fascinating little thing. Because of our modernist tendencies, we tend to see the soul as somehow living within the body, like the Cartesian, it's the captain of the ship. Right? It might be in the brain, the pituitary gland, wherever you want to put it. For St. Thomas, directly the reverse is true. It's the body that is shaped by the soul. The material exists within the spiritual, not the other way around. Okay? So the soul is what makes the body what it is. The body, the material, of course, we share with animals, has its own sort of functions. It's alive, but it has things that we share with animals, digestion, movement, sense, emotion, passions. But it also has this higher side. The body is certainly made for the soul, St. Thomas argues, but this does not mean that the body is a mere instrument. Because even though the soul can live without the body, the human soul is such a substance that it needs the body to be complete. Soul is not itself without the body. And St. Thomas's insistence upon this fact is not only consistent throughout his life and his work, he holds it often to what we might consider to be an extreme. He insists, for instance, that once the elect die and are in the beatific vision before the general resurrection of the dead, that they are in fact not fully human persons, because they do not have their bodies. Now that's, of course, compensated for sufficiently by beholding the vision of God, right? But they're not fully human persons until the general resurrection of the dead, and they're reunited with the glorified body. Of course, knowledge, there is an immaterial element in the soul, in our ability to engage in abstract thought, but nonetheless, the soul needs the body in order to think, in order to take in information from the world. Even when we are thinking abstractly about concepts about which you can't really quantify or measure, like concepts such as love or freedom or God, we're using the imagination, the body, to actually imagine and to visualize something of these concepts. This is one of the reasons the church has, in the last 50 or so years, has been suspicious of and cautious about forms of prayer that attempt to tell you that you need to clear your mind and center yourself. There is no such thing, and it is impossible from a Catholic perspective, to clear your mind. All right? When people tell you to clear your mind, what do? You think of a brick wall or a blank wall or what? Well, there's still something in there. It's a blank wall, all right? So that's why Catholicism is inherently suspicious of any sort of prayer or method of spirituality that seeks to empty out the mind from any imagery, because it's not possible in the long run. He is so consistent, as I say, that this is exactly what distinguishes our personhood from the personhood of the divine persons of God in the Trinity and the personhood of the angels. We are embodied persons. We are made to be embodied. So that notion of how we learn, how we process information, how we move from things that we take in, our sense images, our sensory data, to chomping on it and coming up with more thoughts and conclusions, thinking of abstract thoughts, for St. Thomas, that always requires tangible experience. Which also explains why people who are more intelligent about these things often tend to be the people who are more imaginative. Right? This is often a mark of high intelligence, right? That people who are thinking, they know how to make better, quicker connections because they're putting things imaginatively and concepts together in their mind, in their brain, quicker than I am and than you are. Some of you probably are these people. Now, human nature demands that we have soul and body. Sexual difference. For St. Thomas and for the Catholic theological tradition, the body and sexual difference is not incidental. We don't have time to go into it tonight, but there are rich reflections in the Christian tradition on the Genesis narrative of man naming the animals and the creation of Eve. The body is what reveals to Adam his difference from the animals. He is not like them. They are not suitable. And it is also the body that reveals that Eve is. Because notice that he does not notice the physical differences between him and Eve. He notices that she is at last bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She is like me. Now, the body is implicated necessarily, therefore, in original sin. Moving on to my second point. It's implicated in sin because the human nature is implicated in sin. You see it already in the litany in Genesis chapter 3 of the various effects of the body. The effects of sin on the woman, pain in childbearing, a desire for the husband, which suggests a sort of concupiscence, a desire that cannot be satisfied, ultimately. Sorry, men. Effects of sin on the man, right? Toiling the ground, and of course, returning to dust. Death enters the world. It was, after all, in Genesis, the lust of the eyes, a desire, a craving that initiated the sin. Genesis 3, chapter 6. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise. So the first movements there is bodily. It's good for food, it's a delight to the eyes. Much later in the New Testament, in the first letter of John, you will read about a sort of triple lust of sin, right? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Okay, all three are there already in Genesis 3:6. The articulated effect of original sin on us, you know, Church teaches, is that the mind is darkened, the will is weakened, and the passions are inflamed, concupiscence. We are no longer in harmony with ourselves because we are no longer in harmony with God. For Aquinas, the question of our creation, this is something that in the 20th century was argued, often completely missing the point, that in Genesis, and St. Thomas expands on this, there was never in God's intention for us to live without being in his grace. And so this question of what we are apart from God's grace, like if there's such a thing as a human nature apart from grace, for St. Thomas, that was not God's original intention. Sin does that. Sin separates us from God's grace. And because of that, everything is discombobulated. Right? Everything falls apart. We see it immediately. Notice their first two reactions. Their eyes are open, and immediately they realize they are naked. So the physical differences now, which before had been signs of similarity and union, are now signs of difference that must be hidden by fig leaves. Right? Some ways you might argue that everything we have in the world today, from banks to armies to tanks and missiles, are sort of very advanced forms of Adam and Eve sewing things together to do what? To hide that which makes us most vulnerable from the other. And they hide from God. So overreaching and then hiding in their vulnerability. So their vulnerability has to be covered. And then there's tension now in the sexual relationship. Now, one question that often comes up and has come up in sort of the history of Catholic thought, which, once again, I'm going to suggest St. Thomas most, you know, settled, which was sort of solemnized in the Council of Trent, is how is it that the sin of Adam carries over to you and I? And often you'll hear, going back to the flesh, that is carried over merely in the sexual act. That's not exactly true. It's not specific enough. There were some church fathers, Gregory of Nyssa comes to mind, St. John Chrysostom alludes to this, who suggested that there would have been no sexual activity before the fall. St. Thomas is very clear that that's not true. Right? That this is a good of nature. He talks about various goods of the human nature, and procreation is one of the goods of nature. So if you were to suggest that sexuality is a result of the fall, then you inherently, and to be honest, some in the Catholic tradition over 2 millennia have done this, is to suggest that inherently sexuality is generally sinful. St. Thomas is not one of them. Romans 5:12 is sort of the locus here. Sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin. So death spread to all men because all men sinned. And the presumption here, the way the Catholic tradition has read it, all men sinned in Adam. Now the key here, and what was settled by Trent, is that the sin of Adam is a sin of the human nature because he is the progenitor. He is the first. All human nature comes from Adam. Okay? So it is not sin by imitation. So it's not simply that we do what Adam did. His human nature is the human nature in which we all share. Okay? Following me? So for St. Thomas, it's not simply that sex is what transmits original sin. It's that human nature, when it is transmitted and you are participating in the human nature, you are participating in the human nature as from Adam himself. Okay? He is everything, all human natures exist, all human nature, singular, exist in Adam. So all people who are born are considered as one in Adam, not by imitation of Adam, but by generation from Adam. The analogy that St. Thomas often uses is personal sin, the sin of you and I, so that when we sin, so for instance, let's use something very simple. If I sin by hitting somebody in anger, we might say that, we would not say that my fist is what is sinning, but the movement, me, the mover, I'm the one that's sinning, not my fist. He draws a direct analogy between that and Adam and our race. That Adam is sort of like the mover who starts it all. And we're the members of the human nature. Now, what you see here is primarily, the bad news is we all share this one sin. The good news here is, immediately, in Catholic belief, is this understanding that all human beings share in a certain solidarity in the human nature. Regardless of ethnicity, belief, sex, background, we are all sharers in this one human nature, which we have all received from Adam. The body is implicated in human nature because, as I said earlier, human nature includes both body and soul. And so the soul is implicated, but so is the body. You think of St. Paul's line in Romans, I do not do the good that I want to do, but I do the very thing that I hate. The flesh is warring against the spirit against the flesh. So that once we have sin, once sin is in the world, once original, we are all sort of living with this weight on our nature, this discombobulation of not having everything in harmony, as Adam and Eve would have had it before the sin, in which they knew the good, they could do the good, in which passions were sort of moderated by reason because their reason was subjected to God. Now, it is these struggles with the body that everyone experiences, no matter how holy or how advanced you are in sanctification. And I'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of my time tonight, why that still is the case, no matter how far you proceed on the spiritual life. It struggles with the body in both Christianity and, I would say, in culture, that has sometimes led to exaggerations, perhaps overly rigid or harsh views about the body weighing down the spirit. So I think about some of the first monks or first hermits, some of the desert fathers. Simeon the Stylite comes to mind, if you know his story of, you know, staying on the pillar for, 30 years with just to discipline the body and just pulling up baskets of bread. Or other practices that we've seen throughout history of whipping the body, overly, like drawing blood as a discipline to the body. I'm not discounting that we need discipline. I'll come to that in the end too. The Middle Ages being overly, and even some of the church fathers being overly concerned with sexuality or sex, even within marriage. Augustine, for instance, now we all probably know Augustine's history on this matter, but that sex is somehow a tolerable evil that we need to do to propagate the species. This was often because it was understood, rather realistically, that the sexual act is one of the, is a primary example of a time when the body and the passions of the body can overrule the higher parts of the soul, the higher parts of reason. Right? St. Thomas clears a lot of that up in his own thinking, which I can go into during questions and answers if you want. This is also why for St. Thomas, intentionally getting drunk is a mortal sin, because to intentionally get drunk is in fact is to make the body overrule the reason. And the reason is one of your great gifts from God, the greatest gift from God that makes us like him. I would say one of the problems we have now, this is just a quick digression before I move on to my third point, that it's not that secular society, despite what people want to say, takes the body more seriously than the church. It's that secular society often takes the body not seriously enough for what we want, what we believe it is. Now, in the middle of all of this, to my third point, is the revealed fact that the Son of God assumes a human nature, walks among us, suffered for us, died for us, and rose. That's the central fact of Christianity. This is the stumbling block, 1 Corinthians. Now, we may be used to this 2,000 years later, but make no mistake that this is a radical thing. It was a radical thing in the history of religion, and it was radical to confront it. It was so radical that it was incomprehensible to even Jesus's, and you see this throughout the Gospels, like the disciples have no clue half the time, right? When you read the Gospels, realize, and you'll see it, there'll be these little passages, they realize after he rose from the dead that back he was speaking about the temple of his body, right? At the time, what's he talking about? So you see that. These later reflections, like, oh, he rose. That's right. That's what he's talking about. You see that in all sorts of questions, you know, Lord, will at this time you show us the Father? You know, are you going to restore Israel, Jerusalem now? They have no clue while they're with him, most of the time, right? Okay, St. Peter obviously is a very notable exception, St. John. But they're growing because it's so radical. I mean, while there were pagan myths of gods appearing to men and women, sometimes gods who were just merely projections of legendary figures, that God would assume a human nature, all of it, body, blood, and soul, that he would have a human soul, a human body, human blood, be able to believe, completely new, radical. It was so radically incomprehensible that it took the church, Christians, through various synods, ecumenical councils, champions of the faith, preaching, sometimes battling and coming to blows with those preaching erroneous views about Jesus Christ, centuries to figure out the ramifications of all of this. Centuries. Mostly settled by the 5th century, but some persistent heresies enduring about Christ having two natures and one divine person all the way into the 7th century. Over 600 years to figure this out. And still, heresies endure today about him. It's understandable. He assumed real flesh, the whole human nature. The Gospels on this are clear. He is born, he grows, he eats, he can be touched, he can suffer pain, he can die. All things that the human nature does. But it's so shocking that it's understandable that heresies like Docetism would have risen so early in the church's life. It's the heresy that his flesh was only an appearance. He really didn't suffer. It was a show. Okay. In some ways, it's understandable that Gnosticism and Manichaeism would rise. The idea that this world is evil, look at all the troubles we have to deal with in the world, even if in peaceful times, with growing old and passions, and body often seems our enemy. This gets more clear the older you get, right? The idea that the world is evil, that the body is evil, and that such a good God would not come into contact with it. It resurges now and then, this heresy. This is the heresy that started the Dominican order in the 13th century as we sort of battled the Albigensians. That's why the Genesis narrative about goodness is so important. These are real questions for Christians, and we can't take them for granted, what they mean for us. When it comes to the incarnation, the passion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, we have to be very clear. Absolutely and simply speaking, God could have chosen to redeem the human race in any number of ways. St. Thomas is clear on this. He does have an infinite mind. He could have chosen not to redeem the human race. We have no rights with God. I can't take one of my little points tonight, take that one home, right? We have no rights with God. There's no right to exist. There's no right to be in relationship with God, let alone to be restored to that relationship after sin. None. If he were to create just one person, or redeem just one person, or create all of us, and redeem all of it, we would reckon an infinite act of mercy, even for just one, because of the infinite expanse between him and us. But time and again, St. Thomas asserts, and with him the church's tradition, that on this matter, the way God chose to redeem the human race was not only according to his eternally preordained plan, but that it was the most fitting way. God always does things in the most fitting of ways. In the very first article of the very first question in the third part of his Summa, the part where he deals with the new dispensation of Jesus Christ, who he is, the Blessed Mother's sacraments, the part that he did not finish, the first positive point for the fittingness of God's incarnation, his sed contra, if you will, to all the arguments, suggesting that God should not become incarnate, he writes this. It would seem most fitting that by visible things, the invisible things of God should be made known. For to this end, the world was made. And then he cites Romans 1:20, that famous passage, ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature, his eternal power and deity has clearly been perceived in the things that he has made. You see this throughout the gospel. He who sees me sees the Father. Christ in his humanity is now the face of God. In his humanity, God is touched, seen, heard. Then St. Thomas, in the same set contra, cites St. John Damascene, the last of the church fathers, 7th century. By the mystery of the incarnation are made known at once the goodness, the wisdom, the justice, and the might of God. Each of these four things plays into Aquinas' understanding of the incarnation and redemption of Jesus by Jesus Christ. Let me just briefly explain the four. John Damascene writes that the incarnation shows forth God's goodness, quote, "For he did not despise the weakness of his own handiwork." God made the human nature. It's his work. He declared it good. We broke it. He knows how he made it. This is an important point. He knows how he made us. He knows how we learn. And so God teaches, he reveals, he communicates his grace to us in ways that we can receive. And he does this not because he is true to us, although he is, but to be primarily true to himself and how he created us. He is faithful to his creation as he willed it to be. His human nature that he assumes is ours, without sin, without the defects of sin, but it is our human nature. He now shares in that solidarity with you and I, regardless of creed, gender, ethnicity, or any of the other things that we use to try to separate ourselves and distinguish ourselves. This is why it was so important for the church to understand that Mary is truly the mother of the divine word born in his human nature. He was born, the Nicene Creed says, ex Maria Virginem, of the Virgin Mary. There were all sorts of heresies about this, that, for instance, that he was just sort of passing, he just sort of passed through her. Right? I don't know how that works. If he was just going to sort of pass through in water, I think, was one of the church fathers. Church fathers suggested. I forget which one, don't ask me for a name. No, his human nature is from her. It's the same stock as our human nature, the human nature that is one in Adam. So, that's the goodness of God. Justice, Damascene says, God's justice is revealed in the incarnation, since on man's defeat, he caused the tyrant to be overcome, and yet he did not snatch men forcibly from death. Oceans of ink, friends, have been poured on the atonement of the Passion of Christ. Was all the blood necessary? Is it just the act of a vengeful God, an angry father, taking out on his sinless son what he most wants to do to our sinful humanity? Now, there's no doubt the scripture attests that God did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, Romans 8:32. St. Thomas himself acknowledges, this is a direct quote, "It is indeed a wicked and cruel act to hand over an innocent man to torment and death against his will. But this would be the case if Christ were not also a divine person who in his divine nature shared one divine mind and one divine will with his Father. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have power to lay it down and power to take it up again." So, Aquinas has all of this worked out, naturally. In his divinity, It is the same act of the Father handing him over by which it is the divine Son, sharing one will and one mind with his Father, who gives himself up from all eternity, preordained that this would happen. So his humanity, which he has on his own, is then inspired by his divinity, by the divine will, which is both giving him up and accepting being given up, voluntarily giving himself up. Perfectly united, his human will, his human soul, to his divinity in his one divine person, that then is infused or inspired with charity, love of God, to voluntarily give himself up, even in his humanity. This is an important point, just for further reflection, that everything Jesus Christ does in his humanity, he does out of charity for his Father, for God. You and I are the happy beneficiaries of that relationship. Everything he does for God. He comes to us to redeem us, to give us to his Father. So Christ is both handed over by his Father, but also voluntarily submits himself to his persecutor, to sinners, to us, to take the worst that sin has to give, which is what sin really wants, which is to push God out to kill him, which is what sin does on Calvary, which was what sinners do, only to be forgiven on the third day. The first words out of his mouth, shalom, peace, not words of vengeance or judgment. And this is the great beauty, the sort of grand movement of God, that not only does he not despair of his handiwork, the human nature, but the human nature becomes then the instrument for the defeat of sin and death, to defeat the tyrant, Satan. And yet, Damascene says, this freedom from sin is not compulsory. The other point of fittingness to the incarnation that Aquinas often brings up is that in assuming a human nature, in Christ, we are now able to see all the more just what our humanity is supposed to be, not simply who God is. John Paul will make this a theme of his pontificate. That the human nature, far from being suppressed or oppressed by God, by divinity, in fact, is fully alive, fully actualized, fully virtuous when it's united with divinity, when it's united with God, fully free. And seeing what he did, St. Thomas says, we are all the more strengthened and, dare I say, enticed to follow. Again from Damascene, the incarnation demonstrates God's wisdom, for he found a suitable discharge of the most heavy debt. The debt of our sin against God, both original and personal, is infinite because God is infinite. Remember, we have no rights with God. This is the classic divine exchange theory. And the sacrifice of God-made man, handed over, yet submissive in love, not only is the debt paid, but even more is paid because he's an infinite divine person. And then we become, not only is the debt paid, but we become the inheritors, the beneficiaries of the surplus of grace. This is the life of the Christian. Having taken on our nature, we now have the privileges of being the children of God, co-heirs with Christ, through baptism specifically, but also sharing in some ways in his human nature, or as he shares in our human nature, in all things but sin. So things like calling God Father. The Lord's Prayer is something no Jew would ever pray. Only Christians call God a personal Father, because only we are united to the only Son, Jesus Christ. United to God through him. And for the purposes of this talk, promises of Christ, that if we have been united with him in a death like his, we shall also rise with him. Now finally, Damascene writes that God's might, his power, shows forth in the incarnation, in the passion, because, here's a quote, there is nothing greater than that God becomes incarnate. Nothing. This is the point. Jesus Christ is the culmination of all of God's revelation. There are no more moves for God other than Jesus Christ. He is the moment. Accept him or not at your peril. There are no more romancing, there's no more revelation. This is it. Everything now, from here to the eschaton, is coming to know this and coming to spread this truth. Now, very quickly, to conclude, here are three more little things just to take home with you to consider. Of course, there are more, but here are three that sort of catch my fancy, and since I'm the one giving the talk, this is a great one to give you. While the church is clear that grace cannot be directly, physically sensed, it still is not an abstract ideal, and it's not communicated to us purely ideationally. God communicates it through the humanity of Jesus Christ. His humanity is the instrument of his divinity. Then, through the visible church, which has an invisible component, of course, in virtue of the sacraments, which are visible signs communicating the invisible realities they signify, just like Christ's humanity. Not just pointing to those realities, but actually bearing within themselves the very reality they seek to communicate. The Eucharist, obviously, being the prime example. It's not just pointing you to Jesus Christ, it actually contains Jesus Christ who is communicated in it to you and to me. God uses the means by which we learn and encounter higher truths, which is through images and tangible realities. Grace, staying with this first thing, grace works in this life, in the soul. In St. Paul often talking about the inner man and turning your mind to the higher things. So baptism, we believe, removes the guilt of original sin, but it doesn't remove the sort of discombobulation of the body. This is why you still die, and me. Okay? We still die, we still have to struggle to keep our souls turned to God, but we do and are able to turn them to God because of the graces we receive from God in baptism and the other sacraments. We still have, St. Thomas has an interesting thing, that we can get over mortal sin in this life, but not venial sin. You'll always have venial sins, I'm sorry to tell you. Because venial sins are caused by the body. Venial sins, if you remember, do not turn you away from God. One way to think about it is that venial sin, your aim is right, is there, but it's just a little off center. That's because you have fear, your passions, you know, it's the venial sin of saying, not being malicious, but saying that thing you didn't mean to say, having that extra thing when you know you shouldn't have had it, or that God didn't want you to have it. We still have venial sin. St. Thomas says, that for instance, you might have venial sins that you have to work on of maintaining custody. We use custody of the eyes. He talks about concupiscence. So you might turn to contemplation. I'm gonna maintain custody of the eyes. I'm gonna think about higher things. And then, of course, you get so good at that, then vainglory, he says, comes up. Right? Look how good I've gotten at this custody of the eyes thing, right? Venial sin, right? I like to say to people, the spiritual life is kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, you just sort of have these venial sins coming up every so often. You just got to keep knocking them down, right? This is why the resurrection of the body is so important to us. The glorified soul, having received and grown in grace in this life, it's beholding God in the beatific vision, that goodness, that perfection, it overflows to the glorified body, which is then made capable of receiving. Being one with it. Second point for further reflection is why this is why we take the body so seriously. Why the funerals, Catholic funerals, are the way they are. Why, even with the popularization and the permission for cremation, burial is still a sort of preference. And that the ritual has all these sort of interesting changes whenever you have a funeral liturgy in the presence of cremated remains. Because the body is not simply a carcass. It is your body. And it is your body even after you die. And it will be raised. And it has nothing to do with, you know, ashes and God, trust me, he made you out of nothing. He made your body out of nothing. He can remake your glorified body out of ashes and worms. Right? It has to do with the respect we give to the body. It has to do with our concern about keeping up the body when we live. It has to do also with why we discipline and fast, even from good things. You fast from candy in Lent, or fast from meat on Fridays, not sinful in themselves, so the body can slowly learn that it doesn't need everything it craves for, even those sinful things that often keep your spirit hindered. Finally, Catholicism, and this is sort of the big picture one, Catholicism insists that Christianity and Jesus Christ, theology, revelation, all of it, are not simply theories and ideas, but are centered on tangible realities. The tangible reality of the Word made flesh, the incarnate Son of God, the tangible realities of a culture in which he was incarnate at a particular time in history and lived, in a particular people, the tangible realities of the apostles and the founding of the church, and how these are sort of preeminent because they were there with him, giving preeminence to that, that Catholicism is historical, it's visible, but it's also invisible and supernatural, and the invisible and supernatural is communicated through the visible, in the liturgy, in the sacraments, that it is a true encounter. In fact, for St. Thomas, I'll just leave you with this one final thought. For St. Thomas, this is one of the reasons he thinks that Christ's presence in the Eucharist is all the more fitting. Because he believes that charity and our love of God in this life is a friendship with God. And friendship requires contact and presence. Anyone who's tried to maintain long-distance relationships knows the truth of this fact. And in the Eucharist, we maintain contact and presence with a tangible reality communicating to us the invisible reality of Jesus Christ in all of his glory. Thank you for coming out this evening. We started a little late. Maybe we can just, if people have maybe one or two questions. Thank you.
So you can put out the one will and how they work on some sort of tangible sacrifice of the Son. But then there's this interesting moment though in the Passion when Christ says if you can do this kind of
foot. Yeah, if you can let this chalice pass from me. Right. Right, so different church fathers have interpreted this differently, because it is a difficult thing to, not only that, but also the why have you, my God, why have you abandoned me, right? St. Thomas, when he writes about those passages in the Summa, he tends to rely a lot on St. Augustine here, okay? So for St. Augustine, and once again, these are sort of realities, you're looking at these, in the agony of the garden, what we see is the humanity of Christ, although united to the divinity, nonetheless experiencing what any human nature would, which is fear of the suffering and sort of dread, if you will. But for St. Thomas and St. Augustine, even more so, because there is also a dread or a fear because he knows what he is doing and the ones that can be, what happens for the ones who can be lost, right? So while we read it in a sort of a facile way, he's clearly scared and he doesn't want to do this, for the church fathers, for St. Thomas, that's never actually even part of their interpretation of those passages. Modern people might argue that these church fathers and Aquinas are doing gymnastics to try to defend St. Thomas, or our Lord, but it seems to me when they read it, they're reading it as, yes, his humanity is united to his divinity, but nonetheless experiences sort of the natural, some of the natural passions that we would experience in the face, not only of suffering, but also of the larger realities, which his human mind knows, because it's infused, it's got the beatific vision and infuses, as he infused knowledge. That's another question I have. Okay, so I'm not sure I heard all of that, but let me just make sure I understand. So you're asking, why is the body resurrected? Why is that important for the body to be resurrected if temporal realities reveal supernatural realities? Okay, is that pretty much, okay, there might have been more in there, but that's what I picked up. So, well, first, understand that when we talk about theology, we're always talking about beginning with what has been revealed. St. Thomas, of course, when he talks about various things like the resurrection, or even the question I mentioned tonight, why God is in the second person becomes incarnate, he never presumes on some of these matters to claim to know exact reasons. So I kept using the word fittingness, right? So the fittingness of the incarnation. In the Latin, St. Thomas uses this all over the Summa, conveniens est. It's convenient, it's fitting. So that's when you read the Summa, that's often an indicator. He knows he's not giving you the exact answer because he's not in the mind of God. So when he talks about the resurrection, the question won't be articulated something to this, whether it is fitting that we should rise from the dead. All right? Which means the revelation is we will rise from the dead. Okay. Now, how does that align with everything else we know and with everything else that he has come to a conclusion? That's basically theology. Here's what has been revealed. Here's what we already know based on what has been revealed. Now there's this piece of revelation. How does this align with that? Okay. And the way it aligns for St. Thomas, as I sort of alluded to, is simply that our spirits, our souls, are such that God made them to be with the body. He's got a lot of fascinating things about what the glorified body, and you know there's all these wonderful traditions about, you know, the glorified body will be you at the age of 33, because that's when Jesus, but those are all just sort of fun things. But the fundamental fact is, the body is made to be with the soul. That's how strong we are about the body. One more? Maybe two more, yeah. Let the lady here. Defer to Father Raymond on this, since he's the philosopher, but here's what I'm going to say. Yeah, it is a good question. So look at him. If he starts to shake, yeah, we'll modify. But first, when it comes to infused knowledge, St. Thomas often speaks of impressed species. So like impressed images on the intellect, right? So that there can be knowledge in the beatific vision that obviously does not begin with the body, because the body is not there. Right? But keep in mind, seeing God, you see all the truth of God that is in God, even though at any given moment your mind, because it's not infinite, cannot absorb, if you will, for lack of a better word, all the truth of the vision that you see. Right? Because God in his infinite mind not only knows everything that is, was, and will be, he knows everything that could have been, could be, and could might be. All right. So when it comes to memories, all of that is somewhat, I mean, there is a legacy of that in the spirit, in the soul. But also remember that you're sort of seeing the vision of God who knows all things. So your truth in the beatific vision, what you know, is immediately given to you and from God. So it's a different mode of knowing than in this life. I don't think that answers your question as well as I would want, but there you go.
At the close, we spoke about the institutional church. Before Vatican II, the emphasis was on the continuation of Christ in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How do you
Well, I mean, okay, so did anyone hear the question? The question was this concept that perhaps before the council there was a greater emphasis on the church as the continuation of Jesus Christ's presence in the world, and that after the council, especially Lumen Gentium, the dogmatic constitution on the church of the Second Vatican Council, we see a greater emphasis on church as communio, all right? I would say they're not in opposition, and I don't think the council sees them in opposition, right? So, and when you look at the pontificate of St. John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and even Pope Francis, it's this idea that the body of Christ, Christ the head, Christ his members, this is a communio. It's our communion with him, with God, through the humanity of Jesus Christ, to the divine nature, and as his members, our communion with each other. That is the communio. So that you have, you can argue, and some have, and it is, and you see this in the church's life and theological tradition, that certain centuries, certain things are emphasized over differently than other things. So, you know, I think of Christoph Schönborn, who often emphasizes that, and John Paul, even in Theology of the Body, that the church is already present in Genesis from the moment of creation, because the church is the ecclesia. It is the calling out and the gathering of. It's the gathering of the people of God, which is his humanity. So that's how I was suggesting. I want to thank you for being here for this evening.
Thank you.